I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, three views of the way we live now online. Social media refuseniks, the role of race in cyber dating, and one writer who calls social media just another refuge for slackers. All that's coming up later in the program. But first, there's a new president in place at Gallaudet University in Washington, D.C. The university includes the world's only liberal arts college for deaf and hard of hearing students. Yesterday, the school's board of trustees announced their selection of T. Allen Hurwitz, the respected leader of the National Institute for the Deaf, as Gallaudet's 10th president. Hurwitz signed the audience after being named, and his comments were spoken by an interpreter.
The recognition of sign languages is critical to the rights of deaf people because having that recognition allows people in other countries who are deaf to advance and to find themselves on par with other individuals who can hear.
The post of Gallaudet University president comes with responsibilities off campus as well as on. Hurwitz now becomes a central figure in the deaf community, a leader of deaf culture and society, if you will. Hurwitz's selection was lauded by students and faculty. It was a sharp contrast to presidential selections in years past that have sparked walkouts and large protests. We wanted to know more about the challenges and opportunities the new president will face. So last Friday, we called on Harlan Lane. He's a professor of psychology and linguistics at Northeastern University and the author of many books about deaf culture and education. He joined us from his home in Boston. And here in our studio in Washington, we were joined by Alexander Abinchukan. He's a student at Gallaudet and the editor-in-chief of the school's student newspaper, The Buff and Blue. We should also mention that Alexander is deaf, and we spoke with him through an interpreter. We began our conversation by asking Professor Lane to review some of the past presidential appointments that have sparked so much controversy and to talk about why feelings about Gallaudet presidents run so high.
Well, I think part of it is the ownership of Gallaudet, if you will, by so many different individuals and groups. It's not just American deaf who feel a sense of propriety, but also all the hearing relatives and friends that they have. And then, as you alluded to, Gallaudet's a beacon for deaf people around the world. So if you're deaf and you really care about the well-being of deaf people and their prosperity, you're bound to care about Gallaudet.
Alexander, how do the students feel about the finalists this time? As we are speaking, the board is poised to make a decision among four people. One is the current provost at Gallaudet. One is the director of the National Center on Deafness at California State University. One is the superintendent and the CEO of the New Mexico School for the Deaf. And one is the vice president and president of the National Technical Institute for the Deaf. So how do the students feel about this panel of finalists?
I think that students and professors alike feel confident that any of those four candidates could have done very well in the position.
There were a lot of people outside of Gallaudet who interpreted the controversy over Jane Fernandez as being won over who is deaf enough. Do you think that's accurate?
I think that that was a spin that happened within the media. It wasn't really about who was deaf enough. Our current president, Dr. Robert Davila, is himself not someone that we would claim as being 100% proficient in American Sign Language, but he represents us well. And although Dr. Fernandez is deaf and signs, we didn't feel that she was representative of the deaf community. And I think that that was more the heart of the issue.
Professor Lane, what do you think about that?
Well, I agree with what Alex has said. That was my perception from off campus, that there were doubts about Jane Fernandez's leadership. But I think it wouldn't be quite accurate to say that it was utterly devoid of some, at least on the part of some students and faculty, of some strong feeling that, look, this is Gallaudet. This is the only liberal arts university for the deaf in the world. And for those students who are part of the minority that uses American Sign Language is really like an ethnic group, for them as for other ethnic groups, this land is heritage land. It's very important to their sense of themselves and their future. So I think those students were at the heart of the 1988 Gallaudet Revolution and at the least showed the students of 2006 that where there's a student determination for reform, it can succeed.
So I want to ask each of you, and Professor Lane, I'll start with you. What are the major challenges that the new president will face, whoever he or she turns out to be? What are the major things that the communities want this president to take on? And I imagine there might be different opinions about that. So, Professor Lane, why don't you start?
Well, they're numerous and daunting, in fact. For one thing, most deaf students today enter the university from mainstream programs. So many of them are not used to the world of the deaf, and for some that will be a huge and liberating discovery. For others, they will struggle with using the language. So the diversity of the student group, there are also most such institutions in America, the schools for the deaf, have moved toward incorporating more multiply handicapped students. So the diversity of the student body is one challenge. Another is the fact that Gallaudet is a federally funded university. So the president has to think not only about what's right for my institution, but also what's going to be acceptable and workable with the Congress.
Alexander, what do the students hope to see with the new president? What are the particular challenges to take on?
We want to position the university in a good way so that many of us will have good future opportunities working in the hearing world. And sometimes that position is quite fragile. Gallaudet is the only place in the world where we can be completely normal. Often we grow up in a world that is hearing. And at Gallaudet, we're just regular people.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. I'm joined by Harlan Lane, professor of psychology and linguistics at Northeastern University, and Alexander Abanchuchan. He's editor-in-chief of Gallaudet University's newspaper, The Buff and Blue. We're talking about the state of deaf education in America and the challenges and opportunities Gallaudet's new president will face. You know, it sounds to me, when I hear you talk about this, it sounds to me in the way that many people look on the role of the HBCUs, the historically black colleges and universities, which is that you provide kind of a respite in a place where you feel, how can I put this, you can relax in a way for a couple of years and not constantly have to think about your identity as a deaf person, but then you also want to be prepared to go out into the world and do whatever you want to do. But what does that mean that you want from the president? Is it you want to focus on strengthening academic programs, or do you want to be, you know, highly visible in the hearing world as an ambassador, or both?
Oh, certainly both. Yes, certainly both. We would love to be able to raise the education at Gallaudet University to higher and higher standards. We always think about that. And then we also want to be honest about the challenges that deaf people do face and make the world a better place for deaf people.
Professor Lane, what about that? You know, what is that? In fact, you've written a book contending that the hearing world should not look at deaf people as having a disability. And I'm sure for some hearing people, that's perhaps counterintuitive. But you draw the analogy of being deaf as like being part of an ethnic group. Can you talk more about that?
Well, I do propose that way of rethinking this minority because, first of all, the properties of the minority that are the properties of an ethnic group, and most of all, language. To put it very concisely, I think the fact that the deaf world shares language brought with it the sharing of a culture and a history of struggle. And the hereditary roots of the deaf world in America today are very important. I think the disability model has not served many deaf people very well.
But what about with all the new technology that is now available? In the last century, there was this debate over manualist versus oralist learning styles, the use of sign versus teaching deaf people to read lips and communicate orally. And then now, of course, I think there's this big debate over the use of technology. How is that changing the conversation about education at Gallaudet?
My perception is that it hasn't changed all that much, I'm sorry to say. Cochlear implants, which deaf youngsters increasingly receive nowadays, are a measure to get them to speak and hear. And that has always been the program of those who are oralists, dating back to the 16th century, in fact. So there's a new tool, but it's the same agenda.
Alexander, what do you think about that? And I'm mindful of the fact that technology changes the way hearing people communicate. I mean, I can't tell you how many times we send an email to each other across the room instead of just getting up to go and speak to someone. So what's your thought about this?
Yes, I want to make sure that people understand that a cochlear implant does not cure deafness immediately, that even though the person may be able to hear things that they weren't able to hear before, it doesn't fully integrate them into the hearing world. That takes a great deal of training, a great deal of therapy, a great deal of practice, and it can be very frustrating.
Professor Lane, finally, we've been talking a lot about deaf education in the United States, but you did mention that the president of Gallaudet has this international platform. So I did want to ask, what are the current trends in deaf education around the world, and how does deaf education in the U.S. compare to education systems in other countries? And is the new president expected to be a player in that?
Well, I certainly hope the new president will be a player in that, and that means that Gallaudet will be a player in that. We mustn't abandon all the deaf children and adults in the world who can profit by what Gallaudet has to offer, not only by bringing them to Gallaudet, but by inspiring institutions in their country. You know, there are a few countries ahead of us, I would say, in deaf education, particularly in the Nordic countries. But for most of the world, what a deaf child is allowed to accomplish depends on what they think a deaf child can accomplish. So in Burundi, for example, in Africa, there are no deaf children in the regular school system, because it's obvious to everyone that a deaf child couldn't go to school. In France and other countries, until very recently, it was obvious that a deaf child could go to elementary school, but they couldn't really go to high school. It would have to be some kind of technical training. And so when America has this liberal arts university for the deaf, this sends a message around the world that deaf people can achieve what hearing people can achieve if you allow it, if you create the institutions that permit it. So that's the heavy worldwide burden on Gallaudet's shoulders.
Harlan Lane is a professor of psychology and linguistics at Northeastern University. He's also the author of several books on the deaf, deaf culture and education, including The People of the Eye. He was kind enough to join us from Boston. And here in our Washington, D.C. studio, Alexander Abinchuchan. He's a student at Gallaudet and the editor-in-chief of the school newspaper, The Buff and the Blue. We also want to thank Phyllis Rogers for interpreting. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Goodbye, Michelle. Thanks for having me.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, former Cosby Kid Raven Simone is just in her 20s, but she's already become a multimedia entertainment mogul. Now we find out what music she likes to listen to. That's a little later in the program. But first, we hear from one of the wise old men of rap. He may have been born Robert F. Diggs of Brooklyn, New York, but the world knows him as the RZA, hip-hop's resident wise man and co-founder of the Wu-Tang Clan, one of the most influential rap groups of all time.
Cash rules everything around me. Cream, get the money. Dollar, dollar bill, yo.
Not only is the RZA a Grammy-winning producer, he is an author, an actor, a chess fiend, the composer of film scores for movies like Ghost Dog and Kill Bill. But it's actually the author part that draws the RZA to our New York studios today. He has just published his second book called The Tao of Wu, and it's, well, why don't we let him tell you? Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
How would you describe the book? Kind of a memoir, parables, book of wisdom? I mean, if you were to wander into the bookstore, where would you want them to put it?
I prefer to put it where they put the wisdom section at, because I think it definitely is a book of wisdom. And originally, that was the original working title, was The Wisdom of Wu. And we decided to call it The Tao of Wu because the word Tao means the way. And it's like the way or the path that I traveled, and some of the Wu-Tang members traveled to get to where we are today, with little knowledge and precepts and parables and morals throughout the travels.
You traveled a number of paths. That's, I think, one of the things that people will appreciate about the book. And you're honest about all of them. Any hesitation about putting all your truth out there?
Yeah, definitely with some hesitation. I mean, this is not an autobiography. I mean, I could have put so much more crazy things about my life into a book, but I didn't want to do that. But even the things that's in this book, some things was not easy for me to express to the public. But I realized that sometimes your pain could be another man's gain in a positive way, meaning that, you know, they say, you know, everybody can learn from their own mistakes, but to learn from the mistakes of others is what a wise man would do. And I realized that experience is sometimes the best teacher, but we shouldn't all have to go through the same experiences. If I touched the stove and realized that it was hot, you shouldn't have to touch the stove. And this book is like me touching the stove first, so you don't have to touch it. You know what I mean?
Let me just read something from the introduction where you talk about some of the life lessons that you had to learn at a very young age. You write, imagine you're 8 years old, going to the store with 35 cents to buy a pack of Now and Laters and a bag of sunflower seeds. You get there, three teenagers choke you with an umbrella, take your 35 cents and buy cigarettes. That's the project. Math and economics class on every block. You wonder why the jail and the courthouse are so close to the project. When you get locked up a few years later, you learn. You learn civics, government, law, and science every day.
That's real.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes you I reflect on those things, and you know, like I said, they're not glamorous memories. So sometimes it hits me in the heart. But like I said, if somebody else could gain some wisdom out of it and gain the lesson that I got out of it, you know, it's worth putting inside the book.
In the book, you lay out your seven pillars of wisdom based on seven formative events in your life, and you start off with the call, saying in every story, there's a call. Can you tell us more about that?
You know, I think it happens in every life, actually, not only every story, but if you go throughout the Bible, the Quran, and all these wise books, and even my own life, there's always a moment that you hear something that changes you. Malcolm X said it, you know, he got it in prison when he heard the words of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. Moses from the burning bush, the Prophet Muhammad in the cave. We get this call in your life, and when you get the call, we must answer the call. Now, I just take it to a practical, modern-day thing. I'm an actor inside of movies, right? And that started from a call. Mr. Harvey Weinstein from Miramax movie called me up. RZA, I want you in my movie. You have a new career now. And I answered that call, and I went, and I did his movie, and he was correct. It led to a whole new career for me. So the call comes. Be prepared to answer it.
If you're just joining us, this is Tell Me More from NPR News. We're talking to the RZA of the Wu-Tang Clan and so many other lives and ventures. He's just published his second book, The Tao of Wu. One thing that you talk about in the book, which is also a pretty amazing episode, which I think you may have discussed before, is when you were tried and acquitted for attempted murder. But that was not your only close call with a really dangerous situation. I mean, there was another incident where you talk about where you could easily have been killed in a brawl. Right. And somehow or another, it passed by you. That put me in the mind of a story that's very much in the news about this 16-year-old boy in Chicago who was beaten to death on his way home from school a couple of weeks ago. And I wonder, when you look at something like that, when you look at all the things that you went through, you know, what do you think? Does it ever stop?
That's a tragic incident right there. And the thing of that incident that I would get out of it is, you know, the tragedy of him is one thing, but then the tragedy of the whole community is another. And he becomes now the sacrificial lamb. You know, he becomes that body nailed to that cross now, because his death now brings awareness and awakens the country to what's going on every day out there, yo. That, you know, that happened to him that day, but this is, you know, I got friends from Chicago. When we did the song Cream, right, from Wu-Tang Clan, we had attracted kids from all over the country, and we wound up having like five cool guys from Chicago that was tough, and they would come to New York with us, and they would start reading books with us and things like that. Would you believe that every one of them is dead? My five friends, within 5 years, they all were shot and killed. So this happens constantly in Chicago, Compton, and all around our country.
Let's see. You are a father also. Yeah. Do you think that when your children are the age you are now, that we'll still be having this conversation? We've been having it for a long time. Do you think it's going to stop?
I do have a strong faith that it will stop, because things that we didn't imagine already, you know, see Mr. Obama take the presidency is something that, you know, listen to hip-hop, and we have songs called Black President, or Richard Pryor and Dave Chappelle got funny skits that this could never happen, but it happened in our lifetime. So to me, evil is not a natural nature. It's an alternate nature of man.
What are you hoping people will draw from this book? And particularly, is there someone in particular you are hoping will find this book?
I would like the young people to find this book. I mean, it's good for anybody, but definitely for young people, because we are the ones that seem like we have to figure it out on our own. We have to figure life out on our own when you're young. You know, me being a young man growing up in New York and doing sex at early age and doing drugs at early ages and not really having a full childhood is something that deprives us of being a full man. I look at my son. I have a 14-year-old son who's a virgin, never had a cigarette, have no desire for cigarettes. He's just a kid still, yo. He's still such a kid. He still want a toy. He still like toys of us. But And I would talk to my buddy Tarantino about this, you know, about my life and my son's life. And he pointed out, he said, you know what? Be proud of your son because he's having a chance to have a full childhood. But us in the hood, 12, 13-year-old, we out there sometime trying to take care of our families, 15, 16-year-old with a baby. I would like people to read this book and skip over some of those pitfalls that stop us from growing to our full maturity. And some people, we still have a long way to go, but we are now have a new plateau to measure from, a new whole way of looking at it. My 3-year-old son, every time we turn the news on, he goes, Obama? You know what I mean? He has a new pinnacle now.
A fact of black president is a fact of life for him, not a subject of a comedy routine.
Exactly.
It's the way it is. I can't let you go without asking what you think about hip-hop right now. Big debate last year, I think, was Nas with hip-hop is dead and all this. I feel like I have to ask.
Yeah, I don't think hip-hop would never die. I just think it needs more substance right now. The good thing about hip-hop is that more families across the country are benefiting from it, you know? It started in the East. It fed a lot of us. It fed the West Coast. Now it's feeding the brothers in the South and the Midwest. So it continues to be a great commodity for our people. But the way that it's having lack of substance, I'm disappointed. And I would hope that some of the hip-hoppers out there will start adding more substance to the lyrics.
The RZA. His latest book is called The Tao of Wu, and he joined us from our bureau in New York. RZA, thank you.
Thank you very much, Michelle.
Commentator Bill Harley is a storyteller and songwriter, so he's used to getting up in front of folks and performing. But all that center stage attention was making him a tad self-centered. A singing assignment helped him get in touch with his more humble side.
I got a call from the offices of the local minor league team asking if I wanted to sing the national anthem at a ball game. Sure, I said, with barely a thought passing through my little brain. How cool is that? Singing in front of thousands of people at a baseball game. I might even get good seats. That was as far as my thinking went. As the day approached, I did think about it. What was I thinking, I thought? Singing a cappella is challenging enough. Singing the Star Spangled Banner is something more. It all depends on starting on the right note. And if you don't, you're halfway through the song before you realize you're going to have some trouble at the end. Big trouble. I practiced. I told my friends I was doing it, and more than one of them said in a slightly disbelieving tone, "You are?" "By yourself?" one asked. The day came. The fans filed in. I stood close to the first baseline, wondering what I had gotten myself into, hoping for a reprieve. It was bat day. Thousands of children swung bats in the air, looking for something to hit. A bad day to do a bad job at the national anthem. Abuser of national anthem found beaten to death with Louisville Sluggers, the headlines read. I kept checking out my starting note, saying under my breath, "Oh, say, can you see? Oh, say, can you see?" The events manager led me out to my place in front of the pitcher's mound. "I can't believe I'm doing this," I said to him, hoping he would volunteer to take over. The announcer asked everyone to rise. They all did. Thousands of them. They were all very quiet, waiting for the idiot singer to start. I did. I was pretty sure I got the first note right. It felt like a G to me. I came to the first test. The rocket's red glare. I hit that note no problem. It even sounded good. Hey, I sound good, I thought. I can totally do this. I relaxed into the song. I could hear more resonance in my voice. It echoed off the grandstands and rolled around the stadium like the wave. The sun was shining, the grass was green, the sky blue, and I was singing the heck out of the Star Spangled Banner. Look at me, look at me! Something was wrong. They weren't looking at me, none of them. Their heads were turned toward the right field foul pole. No one was noticing me. What was happening? Someone was stealing my glorious moment. I snuck a quick peek in the direction everyone was looking. Something was there, all right. The American flag. Oh, I thought, it's not about you. I was invisible, so to speak. And being invisible, I sang a little bit better. I nailed the note I'd been worrying about and stayed on it a moment, reveling in my anonymity. I finished and people hooted and hollered. A few people called out to me, applauding my singing. But mostly, I think, their applause was about something else. I walked off the field with a quick bow and a nod. One more bullet dodged, one more lesson learned, again, for the millionth time. It's not about you. It never is about you.
Bill Harley is an award-winning storyteller, songwriter, and author who lives in Seekonk, Massachusetts. His latest CD of songs for families is titled Yes to Running.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
And the real estate bust has struck some working-class neighborhoods in Brooklyn especially hard. The number of foreclosures and abandoned properties has soared, but one housing program known as the Nehemiah Homes has amassed a strong record of keeping people in their homes, and it's done so, imagine this, by carefully vetting each and every borrower. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Yvonne Ziegler was living in an apartment in a housing project when she heard about the Nehemiah Homes. She had a good office job and she made enough to get by, but like a lot of New Yorkers, she figured she'd be renting forever.
I didn't have the aspirations that I could afford a house. So when it came to light that these churches were building affordable houses and how low the mortgages were, I thought, well, maybe this is something I can aspire to do.
A few years ago, she made the down payment on a three-bedroom house where she lives today with her mother. The program that built her house was started in the 1980s by a coalition of Brooklyn churches and synagogues and named for the biblical prophet Nehemiah, who rebuilt the Temple of Jerusalem. Bishop David Banke of St. Peter's Lutheran Church says at the time, whole blocks of Brooklyn had been wiped out by arson and neglect. But a core of working people remained, and Nehemiah figured that turning them into homeowners would help restore the neighborhood.
The idea of Nehemiah was to afford an opportunity for people to own homes in areas of the city that were devastated. And that meant to rebuild them from scratch, and that the people who were going to build these homes were going to be the people who had some skin in the game.
Today, Nehemiah has built more than 4,000 houses on streets like this one. The houses are trim and modest. The words cookie cutter come to mind. But they've provided a bulwark of stability against blight. And that's been especially true lately. Nehemiah officials say a tiny handful, no more than 10 of the houses they've built, have faced foreclosure. This in a part of the city where foreclosures topped 10% last year. The low default rate has much to do with the high hurdles the applicants have to jump over. One recent evening, a handful of Nehemiah homeowners gathered to talk about the program. Zandra Brockman says when she signed up for Nehemiah, she knew nothing about buying a home. The program schooled her in concepts like home equity and amortization.
There were certain guidelines, and then there were certain tests that we had to take to get us prepared to be a homeowner. Because this is an investment. They didn't just want anybody to come in, and you wasn't aware on what you had to do to be a homeowner.
Nehemiah meticulously vetted the finances of would-be homeowners. Buyers' monthly mortgage payments couldn't exceed about 20% of their income. Again, Yvonne Ziegler.
The credit check that I had to go through Nehemiah was much more extensive than through a regular credit check. They constantly monitored where you got your money from, how long your money was in the bank. If you made a deposit over $1,000, you had to prove where you got it from.
A lot of people who applied for the program were turned down at first, says Sarah Plowden, but they would come back and try again. They'd clean up their credit records and start saving for a down payment. And Plowden says as often as not, they would reapply and get accepted.
Well, I was really proud of to know that so many of our people had worked to make sure that they were legitimate. You know, it could say, I can put my name on my credit history. I can put my name on this document and nothing won't come up later on me. So a lot of things came out. We more than just bought homes. We bought into one another as a people.
Plowden says over the years, some people have chafed at the restrictions that Nehemiah imposes. Because of the tough credit and income standards, a lot of low-income people can't qualify. But Alyssa Katz, author of the book Our Lot, How Real Estate Came to Own Us, says Nehemiah has also made home ownership possible for a lot of people who could not otherwise afford it. She says that's partly because Nehemiah built homes on land abandoned to the city, so it could price houses very cheaply.
Look at what it actually did. It brought the entry price into home ownership
down to a level that working people could afford in a very, very expensive city where people who make modest incomes invariably rent.
Then, too, the restrictions that the program imposes on applicants have to be put in context. The kind of thorough vetting that Nehemiah puts applicants through used to be standard procedure. The mortgage market changed, but Nehemiah never did, and that's why it's escaped the subprime crisis largely unscathed. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
School meals have never won any awards for being healthy. Now, the Institute of Medicine, which advises Congress, is announcing recommendations that include limits on salt, fat, and calories. NPR's Patty Naiman reports.
Many school districts are trying to improve their breakfast and lunch menus with nutritious foods like oatmeal, turkey sandwiches, yogurt parfaits, and salad bars. But many menus still include things like fish sticks, nachos, pasta, and French fries. Now the Institute of Medicine says school menus should take another step forward and reflect more of what's been learned over the past decades about health and nutrition. Pediatrician Virginia Stallings headed the committee.
Using whole grains means the foods are less refined and they retain some of the natural vitamins and minerals and dietary fiber. Which is a particularly hard thing to get in children's diets. So by going to whole grain-rich products, we'll improve some of the nutritional intake and also the fiber intake.
So the recommendations say half of all grains served, that includes breads, muffins, and hamburger buns, should be whole grains. They also want to gradually decrease the amount of salt.
If you look at the sodium intake in the high school lunch, currently, it's about 1,600 milligrams. Over this period, we'd like to get that down to 740 milligrams per meal. So you can see that's more than a half reduction.
Schools that adopt the guidelines would limit trans fats and use low or non-fat milk products. Juice would no longer be counted as a fruit. Only whole fruits would count. And for the first time, there'd be a limit on calories per meal. It used to be that the goal of school nutrition was adequate nourishment. Now there's worry about obesity.
One of the choices will not always be French fries or always be corn, because those are only going to appear on the menu cycle every now and again.
It's all good, says Barry Sacken, a health consultant who's worked in the school food service field for over 30 years. The problem he sees is paying for it. Fresh items can be more expensive, says Sacken, especially in colder regions.
I live in Southern California. Access to fruits and vegetables, particularly fresh, almost year-round, is much easier. Trying to find locally sourced fresh produce in the upper Midwest in the middle of January is virtually impossible.
The Institute of Medicine Committee estimates changes to make school menus more nutritious could cost 4% more for lunch and 18% more for breakfast. There are federal subsidies for lower-income children, but those subsidies are the same nationwide, and except for Hawaii and Alaska, they don't take into account regional differences in the cost of food. The recommendations will now be considered by the USDA, which oversees the nation's school lunch program, and Congress will ultimately decide whether to increase funding and adopt these changes. Patty Naiman, NPR News.
American bluegrass musician Ralph Stanley has devoted his life to his music, singing and playing the banjo.
He started performing with his brother Carter in 1946. One of their earliest hits was Man of Constant Sorrow.
I am a man of constant sorrow. I've seen trouble all my days.
Carter Stanley died of cancer in 1966, but with encouragement from his fans, Ralph continued to tour and sing, and the bluegrass legend has written all about his music and career in a new memoir.
This book here?
Yeah, that nice little thing.
I'm running around up here to advertise this book. I'd like to sell about 1,000 of them today here. Anybody wants one? Man of Constant Sorrow.
Anything you left out you want to tell us about?
I didn't leave out a thing. I may have added some stuff.
That's Ralph Stanley speaking with Bob Boylan of All Songs Considered. Stanley visited NPR in Washington and shared a few songs with us for our Tiny Desk concert series.
If you have, that's a little high. Hit me a key, somebody. If you have friends in glory land who left because of pain, thank God up there they'll die no more. They'll suffer not again. Then weep not, friends, I'm going home. Up there we'll die no more. No coffins will be made up there. No graves on that bright Sheol.
That's 82-year-old bluegrass great Ralph Stanley. His new memoir is called Man of Constant Sorrow.
And if you want to hear and see more of Ralph Stanley's live performance, go to nprmusic.org. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.